You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we talk to a Wisconsin native competing on the NBC show American Ninja Warrior, using it to promote math and science education. Now, we may not like to talk about it, but a lot of us have problems with our digestive systems. Just check out the wide variety of products in your local drugstore that help with symptoms of those problems. Our next guest says there's good news. We can tackle a lot of these issues with food, including fiber. A study published by the National Library of Medicine says 95% of Americans aren't getting the recommended amount of fiber. About 60 to 70 million Americans are affected by digestive diseases. Our next guest's secret to gut health, for starters, eat more plants. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about your gut health, how our digestive system works, how it connects to other maybe health problems? Have you made a conscious effort to get more fiber into your diet? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Will Bulsiewicz is a gastroenterologist. He's New York Times bestselling author of the book Fiber Fueled and just out the Fiber Fueled Cookbook, inspiring plant-based recipes to turbocharge your health. Dr. Bulsiewicz, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to have a conversation with you.
Well, in your line of work, I imagine a lot of people are willing to talk about their gut health, but I think in general, maybe we try to sweep it under the rug. How big a deal is our digestive system as a source of a lot of our health problems in this country?
Oh, gosh. I mean, where to begin with that? You know, when we think about our life, first of all, digestion really means access to nutrients, and nutrients that are essential for us to be healthy humans. But it goes far beyond this. If you zoom in for a moment, what you're going to discover if you were to look inside your colon, which is the large intestine, is that there's an entire community of microorganisms that exist. They take up residence within our colon. We call it the gut microbiome. And this gut microbiome, this is a new and emerging, very exciting area within science. I mean, we're really sort of enthusiastic about what we're discovering here. And part of it is because it's connected to not just our digestion, but also to our metabolism, our immune system, our hormones, our mood, our brain health, our energy levels. And you take a step back and you look at everything that's happening in our country, and I could go down the line and we could start looking at all these conditions, and I would just point out to you how every single one of them ends up connected back to the gut in one way or another.
Right. So it's not just about, you know, the obvious stuff, though that's important, the stomach aches, the trouble in the bathroom, whatever. It seems like as I follow some of this microbiome research in our guts, a lot of things that I would have no thought that is connected to my digestion might be connected to my digestion.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like we think about the food that we eat, and there's this optimistic view that many of us have that if we could just change our diet, perhaps we could improve our health, reduce our exposure to diseases. Well, anytime we talk about food, we're talking about these gut microbes. You really can't separate them. If you show me what a person is eating, I could predict what their gut microbiome looks like. And if you show me what their gut microbiome looks like, I could tell you what they've been eating. And so this is where, you know, food really translates into these microbes, which translates into sort of the way that our body works. And that's a fascinating thing because they're not even human.
Before we get into some concrete steps we can take, you have a personal story. You're a gastroenterologist, and you're trying to figure out what was wrong with a patient called you. Can you talk us through your story and what led you down this microbiome path?
Yeah, well, I'm a gastroenterologist whose origins in medicine start in Chicago, and I was the chief medical resident at Northwestern, and I interviewed at the University of Wisconsin gastroenterology program in Madison. This was 13, 14 years ago. But, you know, during this phase of my life, I was working extremely hard, and convenience foods really took up residence in my diet because they fit so perfectly. They were cheap, they were quick, they were easy, they tasted good. And the problem is that I thought I was invincible, but then these issues from a health perspective started to mount. And it almost feels like I woke up one day about 10 years ago, and I was 50 pounds overweight. I had high blood pressure. I had high cholesterol. Was depressed. I was anxious. I had extremely low self-esteem, even though my career was taking off. And I needed a way to fix this. And what I discovered, you know, the sort of ironic thing is that I, the gastroenterologist, I needed to heal my gut. And when I changed my diet, when I drifted away from those convenience foods that really were the central focus of my diet, and I started to consume more foods that were high in fiber, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, seeds, nuts, and legumes, it actually, getting my health back was almost effortless. It just happened. And so as a medical doctor, you know, I sit in a room with patients and I look them in the eye, and these are people that I care about. And when you discover something that transforms your own life as a person, I can't help but want to also bring that to my patients. And so that was a transformative moment in my career.
We're talking to Dr. Will Balsowitz, a gastroenterologist, author of the books Fiber Fueled and the Fiber Fueled Cookbook. You can join in if you have a gut health question at 800-642-1234. If you're wondering if a food is hot or not when it comes to your microbiome, to the well-being of your digestive system, call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Balsowitz, you've already mentioned fiber. I think we've all heard the idea, eat more fiber. What is it? What's going on in our gut microbiome that fiber is so good for?
You know, it's time for us to rethink fiber. We need to fire whoever the PR agent for fiber was in the past. We need to revise this because we've been sort of projected this story that's very boring. You know, grandma stirs this orange drink and that way she can have a bowel movement. And that's sort of the vision of fiber that most of us have. But instead, what I see is something that's really exciting and, dare I say, sexy. It's breaking through in science and it's telling a very powerful story. Because when we consume fiber, which, by the way, it's not hard to find, all plants have fiber. So every single fruit, vegetable, whole grain, seed, nut, and legume, if you eat something that I just listed, you're getting fiber and you're doing good for your gut microbes. Because what happens is the fiber actually is not something that we're able to digest as humans. So it passes through our small intestine, all 15 feet of it, and it arrives into the colon, into this place that I was describing earlier, where the gut microbiome lives, and they get into a feeding frenzy. This is their preferred food. And much like us, when they are well fed, they become stronger, they become more powerful, they become more capable of doing their job. And fiber is their preferred food. And when they consume it, they don't just get stronger, they actually turn around and they repay the favor to us immediately on the spot. They transform the fiber. It stops being fiber and it turns into the most healing, most anti-inflammatory compounds that I've ever come across in my 20 years of studying medicine. The short chain fatty acids. These short chain fatty acids, we could go throughout the entire body because literally they're affecting you from the tip of your toes to the top of your head. But they have healing effects everywhere they go, and that includes in terms of your digestion, metabolism, hormones, immune system, your brain health. It's all there.
So fiber, clearly a rock star. Now, I teased before this conversation, Dr. Balsowitz, coffee. A lot of people curious about this. I saw you have strong feelings about coffee and its contribution to our gut microbiome. Where does it fall?
Oh, well, first of all, let me just acknowledge my implicit bias because I will look for any study that supports the consumption of coffee. But it's actually quite interesting because what we have discovered is that regular coffee consumption actually does change the gut microbiome, and it's in a beneficial way. And so it's not that coffee is bad in any way. In fact, I would argue that coffee is good for us, but instead, sometimes the things that we add to coffee aren't necessarily good for us. So if we could drift towards versions of coffee that, you know, either are black or are including things that are more healthful, then, I mean, truly we're starting our day off with something that's good for our gut microbes.
And fermented foods. I love them. I like pickles and things like that. I hear it from you and others that it's good. But, you know, sometimes that jar of pickles isn't like an active culture, a live culture. Do I have to be careful about the kinds of pickles and sauerkrauts and things like that that I eat?
Well, in a perfect world, what you want is you want living food. And what's exciting about pickles or sauerkraut or other forms of fermented foods is that they include probiotic microbes so that you actually have the beneficial bacteria. They include prebiotics. If people haven't heard this term, let me introduce you. Prebiotic basically means the food that feeds our gut microbes. So any pickle or sauerkraut or plant-based fermentation, fermented food is going to have these prebiotics. And so it's, you know, we were speculating, Rob, when I wrote my first book, Fiber Fueled, you know, to me, it just, it lined up so, so well. It was hard for me to deny that fermented foods, they have to be good for us. But what's exciting is that less than a year ago, Stanford University, actually some people that I am friends with, professors Christopher Gardner and Justin Sonnenberg at Stanford, they did an intervention study and they started feeding people fermented foods. And in just 10 weeks, they noticed that their gut health improved substantially. And they actually had lower measures of inflammation. So now it's not speculation. Now it's fermented food for the win.
We're talking to Dr. Will Bulsiewicz, gastroenterologist. His latest book is The Fiber-Fueled Cookbook, Inspiring Plant-Based Recipes to Turbocharge Your Health. Full phone lines. We'll get your calls in just a moment. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about gut health with Dr. Will Bulsiewicz. His newest book is The Fiber-Fueled Cookbook. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Taylor starts us off in Madison. Taylor, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to ask about, Taylor?
I just had a question about gas and bloating. Like, what causes that specifically?
I bet that's a question you get a lot, Dr. Bulsiewicz.
Oh my gosh. This is the number one. Hi, Taylor. Thank you so much for this great question. This is the number one thing that people want to know about, or a reason that they would go to seek a gastroenterologist. And, you know, let me start off by saying this. Many people would be surprised to discover that they're constipated, even if they poop every single day. The number one cause of gas and bloating that I've come across is actually constipation. And constipation is not whether or not you poop once a day. You could even poop five times a day and be constipated. It's a question of whether or not you're completely evacuating your bowels. And so many people who have this issue, they actually will go, but they don't feel like they've completely emptied. And so this is one of the things that you can look for. This is a starting point in terms of evaluating gas and bloating. Now, going beyond this, it could be a number of different things, Taylor. There are dietary factors. It could be damage or injury to the gut microbiome. It could also be that some people actually swallow air. So they swallow air through carbonated drinks or sipping through straws or chewing gum, and the air has to come out one way or the other. But among all of these things, if I were to start off with one thing, it would be gas and bloating from constipation.
Thanks for the call. Before we go back to callers, what do we do about that if we're using the bathroom regularly but still have, as Taylor mentioned, that bloating? How do we make sure we evacuate completely?
Yeah, so if you have this feeling that you're not completely evacuating, or if you're not going with great frequency, you know, one of the things to pay attention to is, does your gas and bloating improve after you have a good bowel movement? Because we all know what that feels like. You know, you have one of these moments where you strut out of the bathroom in slow motion and there's doves flying and, you know, it's fantastic. So how can we get things moving more efficiently? Because that's what we want. We want to have good, regular, complete evacuations. One of the things that I'll do, Rob, with my patients is actually have them start a magnesium supplement. Now, this is something that you're going to want to talk to your doctor about. Don't just hear this on Wisconsin Public Radio and then go and do it. But if you take a magnesium supplement, specifically magnesium citrate, magnesium sulfate, or magnesium oxide, you can start it before bedtime, typically 400 or 500 milligrams at bedtime. And over the course of time, you may slowly increase this. And you'll notice that this could substantially improve sort of the regularity or the efficiency of your bowel movements. And then if you notice that your gas and bloating improves with that, then you know you're on to something.
Thanks for that call, Taylor. Let's go now to Steve in Milwaukee. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, thanks so much for taking my call. I had a quick question about, you know, I travel constantly. I'm always on the road, and I find it difficult to, you know, keep aware of my diet and kind of eat healthy. I'm curious if you have any suggestions for somebody that's, you know, eating on the road more often, how to stay healthy.
Steve, thanks for the call. And I think the truckers listening are applauding that question. Dr. Bulsiewicz, what advice do you have?
Well, so thank you, Steve. A couple of things. First of all, one of the strategies that you want to use is to take advantage of local supermarkets when you're traveling. So look for a place where you can stop and like pick up some fresh produce. And I'm thinking about things like a snack. So things like fresh fruit, hummus, carrot sticks, things of this variety. Just sneaking it in, just this by itself can be a difference maker. The other thing is that you want to start to pay attention. Like if you know where you're traveling to, take a little bit of time to check out the area ahead of time and have a plan. I feel that having a plan is one of the important things that people need when they're traveling, whether it's for business or for pleasure. You know, thinking about, okay, where are the places that potentially will have food that are aligned with what I'm looking for? That way you're not just kind of falling victim to, oh, I'm not really sure where I'm going to eat. And the last thing I would say is, like, depending on how widely you're traveling, you know, Steve, I'm not sure if you're in the car or whether you're in an airplane, but when you travel to a new place, you know, many times they have like a local food specialty. Find out what's in season, find out what sort of the local food specialty is, and try to hunt that down and try it out. That's, you know, one of the things that can be kind of fun actually is to invest into trying whatever the local seasonal dish is.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. We're talking to gastroenterologist Dr. Will Bulsiewicz, author of books, the books Fiber Fueled and the Fiber Fueled Cookbook. Back to your calls now. Rita is with us in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Rita.
Hi. How are you today? Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, what'd you want to ask about, Rita?
The question that I have is, I have Crohn's disease, so I'm not. I've been told that I shouldn't have fiber. That it's. Bad for my gut health, I guess, if I have fiber. So I have to have white bread, and I have to have white potatoes, and I have to have very bland things. What is this suggestion for me to do? I do take a probiotic daily, but other than that, what can I do to help?
Great question, Rita. Dr. Bulsiewicz, advice for someone with Crohn's disease.
Yeah, so people who have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, I'll include both of these types of people, Rita. These are people who have inflammatory bowel disease. There's damage to the gut microbiome. The inflammation actually has caused injury to the gut microbiome. And because of that injury, you can struggle to process and digest these foods. So there's this sort of paradoxical thing where the food, specifically the fiber, that you need so much to heal your condition is actually the thing that you struggle with the most. Avoiding it doesn't actually make your gut stronger. So what you want is you want to, when you introduce these foods, you start super low and you go slow. So you don't go for the raw monstrous salad, but instead you start off with things that you can tolerate, things like smoothies, soups, things that are cooked like stews. And you can slowly increase your fiber over the course of time. And this is actually a big part of what my new book, The Fiber Fueled Cookbook, is about. It's not just a cookbook. It's actually a protocol for people like you, Rita, who want to add these foods, but they're trying to figure out how to do that.
Rita, thanks for the call and good luck to you in dealing with that. James joins us by Wisconsin Dells. James, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thanks so much for having me on.
What'd you want to ask about, James?
My question was about the currently popular trendy kombucha. I enjoy it, and it's fermented, and you'd mentioned good fermented things earlier, and I wondered what the science says about that.
Thank you, James. Yeah, so I enjoy kombucha, too. I think that, you know, everything in nutrition, it's a question of what are you replacing with what. So if you were taking a, you know, Mountain Dew Code Red and replacing it with kombucha, well, that to me is a step in the right direction. We don't have a ton of science with regard to kombucha specifically. So my recommendation would be to consume this in moderation, meaning that I wouldn't really do more than 8 or 12 ounces per day. And then I would look to sort of broaden out the fermented food in your diet. So don't make it just kombucha, but instead, you know, look for those other things like sauerkraut and pickles and miso and tempeh.
Thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. I should ask, you've touched on this a little bit about, we've talked a lot about the good stuff, the good foods, which is a great way to tackle it. What are some of the things, though, that are not so great for our microbiomes?
You know, the issue, Rob, is that when things are consumed at a reasonable level, we don't have the same level of concern as when we're just going way overboard. And unfortunately, in American society, I mean, if you look at what our diet is made up of, first of all, we're not consuming the stuff that I'm talking about. The average American's diet is only 10% plant-based. And instead, 60% of our calories come from ultra-processed foods. These are things where basically the fiber is removed, but high in sugar, high in salt, high in preservatives and other chemicals, you know, and then 30% of our diet comes from animal products. It's not to say that you, like, for example, have to be vegan in order to be healthy. That would not be true. But I do think that if we could take some of this space, 60% being ultra-processed foods, let's replace that with plants. And then let's look at the rest, which is the animal products, and perhaps we increase our plant consumption a little bit. And what we would discover is all of a sudden we're 80 or 90% plants in our diet. That would be such a healthy improvement for us.
One more thing I wanted to bring up. You mentioned making fiber sexy again. You want to make oatmeal sexy again. You're a big fan of the oatmeal.
Well, I think breakfast is an awesome time to eat the way that I'm describing because you have tons of delicious options that can be not only do they taste good, but they're also good for your gut microbiome. So, you know, oatmeal is one example because what I like about oatmeal is I'm not talking about just like plopping down some oatmeal and then throwing some brown sugar in it. I'm talking about taking oatmeal as a foundation that you then are going to add more plants into, things like walnuts, blueberries, blackberries, raspberries. I could keep going. You guys know where this is. You know, you guys have your own ideas out there of what to put in there. But the bottom line is that the oatmeal becomes a vehicle to deliver these fibers and these different plants into our diet. And all of a sudden, you're thriving.
Dr. Bolsiewicz, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Dr. Will Bolsiewicz is a gastroenterologist, author of the new book, The Fiber-Fueled Cookbook, Inspiring Plant-Based Recipes to Turbocharge Your Health. He joined us to talk about what we can do to improve our gut health. As we heard, fiber, a big part of the story. Fermented foods, also very good. If you have had a turnaround doing some of the things that Dr. Bolsiewicz has been talking about, let us know. And if you have a favorite way to doctor up your oatmeal, tell us about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org with your oatmeal secret recipe. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, check out the latest efforts by some healthcare workers in Wisconsin and elsewhere to join unions or rejoin them in some cases. That's tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. It isn't always easy to get kids excited about doing math and science, but our guest today has found a way to make it active and fun, too. He trained to compete on the NBC show American Ninja Warrior, and he brought students in on the process. He showed them the math and science of the obstacles in the course to give real-life examples of what they were learning in school. Jay Flores is a global STEM ambassador and founder of Invent the Change, his organization that works to promote STEM education. That stands for science, technology, engineering, and math. He grew up in Milwaukee, graduated from UW-Madison. To raise awareness for his cause, he's competing in this season of American Ninja Warrior. Earlier this month, he advanced to the semifinals in Los Angeles. Jay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
What got you so interested in promoting the science, technology, engineering, math to the next generation?
So it's something that I grew up being pretty good at in school, but never really knowing why it was important. I was the student that asked the question, why would I ever use this again in my life? And as I got through my engineering education and I got to get out into the real world, I saw how many cool examples there were of how things were being made and how things were changing the world. And I thought that more people should have the opportunity to be prepared to do those things themselves as well. But I didn't see it in my community and I didn't see it celebrated in a lot of places. So I tried to find unique, fun ways to get students involved.
Yeah. What are some of the things you like to do when you're talking to youth who might ask you that question you grew up asking, what's this going to be good for? How do you make it interesting for them if they're not necessarily going for it right away?
So I try to lead with what they might already be passionate about. I can walk into a room of students or a conference and ask any person what they're passionate about. And there's some type of science or technology behind it impacting how it's created or how it's produced today. So I want to connect with what they already care about and then show them that a STEM career could allow them to go very far in that space, whether that be creating cars, curing cancer, or even playing sports. There's opportunities for everyone in STEM.
And so you're an ambassador for STEM education. What does that mean? What does that look like in your day-to-day job?
Every day is a little different. Every day is fun. As I mentioned, I try to find those real life examples and find examples that are as entertaining as they are educational. So one fun example that I do from home and in my kitchen actually is a series that I created called It's Not Magic, It's Science, where they're at home science experiments that are disguised as magic tricks. And I put them out on my social media channels. And that's one way to reach students and parents that weren't maybe already looking for science, but found it in a cool way, to conferences and events, to the TV shows that have done a wide variety of ways of just really trying to celebrate science so that our society can get the best of the minds of young kids that are curious and just haven't found the real life examples yet.
Talking to Jay Flores, UW-Madison engineering graduate who promotes science, technology, engineering, and math education for kids. STEM, they call it for short. Okay, Jay, speaking of fun lessons, now you worked for years to get on American Ninja Warrior. You ultimately got to do it. And part of this was coming with some science lessons for and math lessons, I think, for the kids. How did you turn those stunts into lessons?
Absolutely. One of the cool things and challenging things about the show is that nobody gets to touch the course before you compete. And as you mentioned, it took me 10 years of trying to apply to finally get the call for the show. And so when you're taking on a course, whether that's at a local gym or on the show, being able to analyze the obstacles and try to understand how they work as well as how your body works in those situations can provide you with a competitive advantage. So I actually started with using it as something to make me a better ninja without necessarily the time of training. And then I figured this might be a fun way to get more kids active while also promoting STEM. And it just was a really good mix of learning by play. And students, I think, were very excited about being able to become a better ninja and have some good examples of why the things they learned in math or geometry or physics really matter in the real world.
I understand in one of the rounds in San Antonio, you had some students bring robots to the stage. What were the robots there for?
Yes, that was incredible. We brought robots on our B-roll day where we filmed kind of my backstory. I got to do some pull-ups with a robot from a team that competes in FIRST, which is a robotics competition for youth. And the next day we had them on stage when I came out, and we had an all girls team from San Antonio along the sideline with the robot, kind of going along the sideline with my family and my wife, celebrating anytime I completed an obstacle. The girls had the robot do donuts and cool things. So they really did a great job of bringing it to life. And that's, I think, what is wonderful about the spirit of Ninja Warrior. It is you versus the course, but there's also so many great stories that are told. And I really wanted to amplify the students and the incredible the work that they're doing, and especially the young girls that are doing great things in STEM.
Let's bring out a caller. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I didn't realize I was going to get on right away. I am wondering why STEAM is not picking up STEAM, meaning the A in art or the arts, because the arts are, you need the science, technology, math, engineering in almost any art. Mm. I mean, they all apply. And I'm wondering why that's not picking up as much steam.
I gotcha, Susie. Thanks a lot. Yeah. So adding arts to STEM to make it STEAM. I've seen projects with that. Whether you bring it in directly, I think the creative element of science and math is something that people often overlook.
Absolutely. And so the way I like to look at it is engineering, the STEM fields, it's just problem solving. And you get to decide the types of problems you want to solve. So early on in my career, I worked with manufacturers and their automation challenges. And now I work with families and kids to get them engaged in science and solve that challenge that we have as a nation and as a world to innovate to solve the problems that we're facing. So I think the key is for teachers and parents to lead with curiosity versus math and science skills. So celebrate and encourage that creativity and curiosity. And eventually, if they're excited and they keep going down that path, they'll learn the math and science skills they need in order to succeed, whether that be in an artistic way, in a traditional manufacturing way, whichever way that they want to solve problems.
Thanks a lot for that call, Susie. Jay, I don't want to leave people hanging. You, after years, got onto the American Ninja Warrior program. It's this, if people haven't seen it, it's this thing where you do these crazy stunts. As you said, you don't get to know what you're going to do before you do it. What was the experience like?
It was incredible. And if you're familiar with any type of TV shows, they look incredible on TV. And in the background, when you're making it, it's a little bit hectic and crazy. And so I was there at the start line and I had to wait. Actually, they decided to take a break. And it's almost like icing a kicker in football, if not worse. And so I was standing there and I just tried to soak it in and think about all the challenges and the things that took to get there, but also the incredible opportunity. And view those rejections as part of the journey of making it so much more special. And I was lucky to make it to an advance to semifinals there in front of my friends and family and all the students. And next, probably sometime in July, if not early August, they'll air semifinals. And hopefully we'll be able to get some airtime there as well.
And Jay, just in our last few moments, can you leave us with lessons maybe for a parent or a teacher listening to help jazz up that STEM education, spark that interest in the kids they work with?
I think everyone is born an engineer. From the time we open our eyes, everything is an experiment. We're very curious naturally. And at some point, unfortunately, society or rejection or failure or a bad grade or a teacher that may have said something kind of puts us down a certain path that we don't think we can be math people. And we don't do the same thing when it comes to challenges with tying shoes, right? So why would we tell someone they're not a math person? We help them and guide them down that path. So anytime you have an opportunity to celebrate curiosity or creativity, allow the youth to ask the question why, even if you don't know the answer, just allow them to explore and experiment. And eventually, you know, later down the road, they'll still be open to exploring these fields, and they'll be much more prepared and ready to take on the harder math and science because they're curious and they're excited about it.
Jay, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. Appreciate your time.
Jay Flores is originally from Milwaukee, UW-Madison graduate, competing on this season of the NBC show American Ninja Warrior, and a global STEM ambassador who promotes math and science education through his company Invent the Change. Coming up, we meet a pair of bread bakers from the UK and hear the story of how they crowdfunded their own shop. That's next year on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. A lot of people turned to baking during the early days of the pandemic as a way to gain some mental and emotional relief in a tough time and to make some delicious bread. Our next guests had already discovered the healing power of baking. They're a daughter and father team who started baking at home and ended up opening a bakery. In their new book, they share their story and a lot of recipes and tell us how baking bread helped them through a difficult time. Kitty and Al Tate are daughter and father. Together, they run the Orange Bakery in Oxfordshire in the UK. Their new book is called Bread Song, How Baking Changed Our Lives. I talked with them yesterday. Kitty, can you share some of the story about how you got into baking?
So growing up, I was always a horrible, horrible baker. I mean, like, if I told people that I was baking, everyone in the house would just make excuses that day to not be around. And I'd make fairy cakes, which I used to get confused between, like, bicarb and baking powder, and they'd just dry your whole mouth out. Mm-hmm. Or my cookies always seemed to be rock hard, even though they were in the oven for about 2 minutes. But then when I was 14, I started to really struggle with anxiety and depression. And I don't know what caused it. It felt like it just came out of nowhere, but it was just crushing. And I couldn't go to school. I couldn't leave the house. Sometimes I couldn't even leave my room. And then one day I watched my dad make a loaf of bread. And it wasn't spectacular. He just mixed flour, water, salt, and a tiny bit of yeast together. And it looked like this gloopy mess. And I kind of took the mick out of him because I was like, ew, I'm not eating that. But the next day he scooped it out and he baked it. And the loaf that came out was just, it was golden and it was warm and it was soft. And it made me feel safe. And I think I hadn't really felt safe for a long time. And I'm quite obsessive. So I got dad to teach me how to make that loaf. And I started to make loaf after loaf after loaf. And things escalated very quickly after that.
Al, from your perspective, can you talk about how you saw Kitty embrace baking and what it meant for her?
Yeah, it was one of these things that was never intentional. So, you know, very little of our journey has ever been intentional, actually, looking back. But yeah, with the baking, it was quite by chance that Kitty happened to be watching me when I was baking a loaf. And yeah, Kitty talks about her baking. My loaf baking was pretty unspectacular, too, until I sort of found this amazing Jim Leahy method. And but yeah, Kitty's depression and anxiety had basically brought the whole family to quite a crushing halt. And we tried everything and anything to sort of pull her out of the kind of bleakness and blackness that she was in. And seeing her respond to the baking was wonderful, because yeah, you just for that small little moment, we just got a glimpse of the old Kitty. So yeah, it was a very, very special moment.
Kitty, I think a lot of people have turned to baking for some comfort over the years. What is it about baking in particular that was so magical for you?
I think it's kind of two things. The first is it completely takes your mind away from yourself. For me, I just had all these thoughts spinning around my head the whole time. And when I was baking, I had to be present and I had to be concentrating on what I was doing. And it's so sensory too. Yes, it's sight, but it's also touch and it's taste and it's hearing. There's so many things that I love about it, but it takes all of you. It takes all of your attention, and I really needed that. And I think the second thing is, at the end of this process and task, you have something. I mean, you don't walk away with nothing. It's not just a fun activity. You have a product, and you can either eat that product yourself, or you can give it to someone or share it with someone. And that's really beautiful, and I love that.
Al, this went from eating the loaves yourselves or sharing them, as Kitty just said, to a bakery. What led you to go all in with Kitty and take this, you know, this hobby slash therapy and turn it into this business?
Yeah. So Kitty's basically a force of nature, and you have to go with that. And so the fact that it went from sharing with neighbours to pop up to then the shop was an extraordinary journey, an amazing sort of momentum. And it was driven by all sorts of different factors. I mean, partly demand. You know, people really wanted our bread, which is an amazing sort of experience. And partly because it was the most important crutch for Kitty to get better. And therefore we were always going to go with anything that could do that. But as I said sort of earlier, there's been very little deliberate decision behind our sort of whole process. So even taking the shop on, I think I secretly thought in the back of my head, well, this is lovely, but real life will.
And we had a deal when we got offered a shop, because again, like Dad said, we never planned it. But our deal was, if we could raise enough money, we could open the shop. And we had about £200, which is not enough to open a shop. So we decided to crowdfund. And the lovely thing about crowdfunding is, if you don't hit your target, it all gets returned, no losses. And we set a target. We gave ourselves 3 weeks, and I think Dad was secretly hoping like we'd maybe nearly reach it and then just not quite, and then they'd put everything to bed. But we hit our target within 48 hours, and at the end of the 3 weeks we had doubled it.
And it's an extraordinary validation, really. You suddenly think, gosh, there are all these people, you know, we might have known maybe 50-60% of them, but there were so many people who we'd never met before, but who'd somehow heard of our story or eaten our bread, who believed in us. And I think that was the critical thing, was realizing there were people out there who felt that this was possible. And that kind of, it did a lot to overcome my kind of natural doubt and conservatism.
We're talking to Kitty and Al Tate. They are a daughter and father team. They run the Orange Bakery in the UK. Their new book is called Bread Song: How Baking Changed Our Lives. Well, let's check out a recipe, Kitty. And this is, I think, a good one for people to start with. We have it online at WPR.org/Food Friday, the Miracle Overnight White Loaf. I need some miracles, I think, in my bread baking. How does this recipe work?
So this is the first recipe in the book, and it's still my favorite. All you need is flour, water, salt, and a tiny bit of yeast. You mix it up. Normally you can do this in the evening. It doesn't have to knead it. You literally have a spoon, takes 3 minutes, and you put a cloth over the top, and you leave it for about 12 hours. So like I say, overnight's best. And then in the morning, you just scoop it out, and you can put it into a tin or a tray if you want to make focaccia or whatever you want, and bake it. It's so simple. It's so easy. It's the first loaf I made. I love it, and it makes amazing bread.
And Elle, Kitty mentioned earlier, she's kind of making fun of your product before this whole process started. Have you, can you talk about your evolution as a baker through it? I know Kitty has really embraced it. Have you gotten to be a better baker along the way too?
Yeah, I've had a nice time in Kitty's slipstream, basically. So I've learned an enormous amount from her. I mean, we basically...
You bounce off each other very well.
And we love the sort of... A huge amount of our bread baking journey has been built on failure. And you learn so much from failing the whole time. And the brilliant thing about bread is it's not like ruining a cake. It's quite, bread is quite simple. It's quite cheap. So you can make mistakes and sort of, you know, pull yourself back from it. So it's been...
If you have to give a loaf of bad bread to the pigs, it's okay. If you have to give like a whole Victoria sponge cake to a pig, that's a lot harder.
Yeah. So it's been great. No, I love it. I've always been a huge sort of bread fan. I still am a huge bread fan. And the fact that I'm getting a chance to make bread and I don't have Kitty's extraordinary sort of intuition and instinct for it. But I'm getting there.
You're definitely getting there.
Now, we've got another recipe online at WPR.org/foodfriday for your sourdough focaccia. Now, we don't need to talk about the recipe, but I want to meet another character in your book, a fella named Ferguson, a sourdough starter, Kitty.
The best kind of fella. So Ferguson was my first starter. And when I first started baking, like I said, I wasn't doing sourdough or anything fancy like that. But the more we sold our bread, the more people started to ask, can you do sourdough? I'd love to buy a loaf. So it was like this challenge, like this mountain that I needed to climb. And I decided that I had to complete sourdough. So I learned everything I could online through books and YouTube videos. And I made a sourdough starter out of just flour, water, and the skin of an apple from our garden, because that has all the lovely natural microbiomes around it. And I mixed it all together and I named him Ferguson. I got very emotionally attached to Ferguson and I would even sleep downstairs next to him. So I made sure that he wouldn't like suddenly die in the night, or it was the opposite actually. I'd be fast asleep at 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock and I'd hear this farting as Ferguson just explodes over the jar.
Oh, that's a great story to leave it with. Kitty and Al, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's
been a real pleasure. Yeah. Been talking to Al and Kitty Tate. They're a father and daughter team. They run the Orange Bakery in the United Kingdom. I talked with them yesterday about their new book. It's called Bread Song, How Baking Changed Our Lives. You can find recipes from their book, including that miracle overnight white loaf, sourdough focaccia, and one we didn't talk about at all, next level Chelsea buns, on our website at WPR.org/foodfriday. Now, if you have a baking story to share, if you find a bread baking or other kinds of baking therapeutic, an important part of your mental health, love to hear from you. If you identified with the story that you just heard there, let us know. Email ideas at WPR.org. Again, that email, ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, an engineer made headlines when he claimed that a Google system, that the company Google, had become a sentient artificial intelligence. Now, it looks like it probably didn't, actually, but the possibility raises a lot of questions for the future. We'll tackle the issue of artificial intelligence, when it might be on the way, what it means for us humans. And pinball is a lot of fun, even though I'm bad at it, but it's more than just a game. We'll dig into the art and the cultural influence of pinball through the decades. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.